We recited the precepts tonight, and this is in preparation for beginning the series on the precepts. And early on in Bright Seas history, we did a series of talks, one a month, on each of the precepts, and worked our way through them all within a year as a sort of preamble for anybody who wanted to take Jukai. So I thought we would dive into it again. And it's, at any rate, not amiss to have a look at the precepts regularly. They're a vital part of the practice. They were originally begun in the time of the Buddha. The monks would have something like 249 precepts, something like that, that they, the vows that they took. We've pared that down a good bit since we are lay practitioners and not monks. In some places, they still do take all of those vows. We've got it down to 16. So we do the three refuges, the three pure precepts, and then the three, the 10 bodhisattva precepts. In Boundless Way, we have multiple times when we take the precepts. One of them is Jukai, which is a public ceremony of commitment to the way. And this is preceded by the study of the precepts, generally with part of a group, but it doesn't have to be. Doing some reading, working with the teacher on the precepts, writing out one's own one-sentence-long understanding of each precept, and then taking part in this public ceremony and reading out those statements for each precept, sewing the raksu ahead of time, and being given your Zen Dharma name, which is on the back of the raksu. This is a big event that happens a couple of times a year in Boundless Way, and the whole community participates and takes the vows with you. There's that opportunity to take the precepts. And then for the teachers and priests, each time that there is a ceremony for them, when I became a Dharma teacher, which is the first level of teaching, much of the ceremony involved taking the precepts along with my teacher. And then when I became a senior Dharma teacher, again, it was a ceremony which involved taking the precepts. And when I had Denkai as a Dharma holder, that first step of transmission, I received the precepts again. And the same thing with Denbo, the final step of transmission, again receiving the precepts. So this is this vital part of the practice that is emphasized at every important milestone. We want to look at what it is that is so important about this and how we go about practicing with it. So we begin with the three refuges. This is, I take refuge in Buddha, I take refuge in Dharma, I take refuge in Sangha. So I have a little story to go along with these. Because this matter of refuge, like what is it? How exactly do we go about taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha? We might have found some ways that that's true for us. But to look at it and see what this refuge really is. There was a time when I was kayaking up north off the coast of Newfoundland. And I was alone, and I had never been there before. So it was a little bit of a fraught experience, although quite wonderful too, very pretty place. And very remote, so I hadn't seen anybody for days. And some bad weather came up. Now, I have this way of incorporating the practice when I'm doing sort of long crossings. Maybe I do a mile or 2 miles open water crossing, and it's kind of boring, you know, there's nothing to look at, there's just water all around, you're doing this, you know, for a long time. And so I have taken to doing the liturgy service as I do this crossing, and I know that there's a certain amount of the chants that I can do that marks about 1 mile. So, you know, if I have a 1 mile crossing, I do one liturgy service. And if I have a mile and a half, I do one and a half, and so forth. But I also will do this at times when I'm not so sure about how things are going out there, when maybe the waves seem a little rougher than what I had expected, or fog has come in and I'm not sure where I am, or some such thing as that. I'll just begin doing the chants. And so it was on this particular day. So the wind was buffeting me, and there were cliffs on one side, and there was nowhere to land, and I didn't exactly know when there would be somewhere to land. And I was really tired. And I had accidentally packed my lunch away in the front hatch where I couldn't get at it unless I got out of the boat, so I hadn't had any food since breakfast, and was very tired and hungry. And so I started to do the chant, and I started with the Gata of Atonement, as we do here, and I have to say that was not terribly comforting, going over everything that I had to atone for. And then on to the three refuges that were next. And so I went through the Sanskrit version of it, the first part, and then I got to the English part. And I found that I didn't want to leave that as I paddled along in these difficult circumstances. So I just kept chanting, I take refuge in Buddha, I take refuge in Dharma, I take refuge in Sangha. And I didn't even know what I meant by it. It just felt like the thing that I wanted to be saying as I was paddling along, exhausted and uncertain how things would go. And I realized somehow that the way that I was using this chant wasn't quite how it was meant to be. It was felt as though I was trying to ward off the situation, to ward off any untoward events. And I knew that that wasn't really how they function. But still, it's where I entered in. A curious thing about the three refuges is that even if you enter in through mud, they will take you back up to the clear water. So my muddy entrance of I just want all this to go away. I want to find refuge somewhere else. Somehow, in the chanting of the refuges over and over, led me to recognize that my refuge was actually right here, that this was the universe unfolding before me, and with me as part of it, of the unfolding, that this was the story of my life right this minute being presented to me, that I was taking part in, and that this was my refuge, to fully embrace it, whatever came next. Oh, how exciting not to know. What a rich life. Even though it maybe wouldn't last much longer, I didn't know. I didn't think it was going to be that dire. But so the precepts guiding the way and finding that refuge, which is always just right here. Someone once, in one of the sutras, I forget which one, someone came to the Buddha, a disciple came to the Buddha, and said, you know, I'm coming to realize that like half of practice is all about Sangha. And the Buddha said, oh no, that's not the case at all. All of practice is about the Sangha. That's the whole thing. So taking refuge in this community, so important. We don't do this as some separate island. You know, it's not just me and my practice here on the cushion. You know, you all are doing what you're doing, but I got my practice going on here. We are all practicing together. We support one another. Even if we think that we are isolated on our cushion, we are utterly interwoven with one another and with the greater Sangha that is this whole world. Our sitting involves the entire universe, and that is where we take our refuge. Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, all coming together. Also, we go on to the pure precepts, the three pure precepts, and that is, I vow to cease from evil, I vow to practice good, I vow to save all beings. They seem so simple. Oh, three short lines. How hard can it be? Cease from evil, do good, save all beings. But we immediately lose our way, especially if we think we know what those things are, what good and evil are, how to go about saving all beings already lost. So this invitation to explore what these mean, to see how we can go about this. And I most appreciate that it begins with ceasing, to cease from evil. It implies that whatever it is that we're doing, maybe we need to stop, just stop where we are and take stock, look about and see what's been going on. And that is what we do so much in this practice, to just sit down in the middle of the catastrophe and take a look at how it's unfolding. What the heck's going on? What is our part in this? What might be our response? Who even are we in the midst of it all? Who is it that's ceasing from evil? What is the evil that's been going on? Is it evil only from our point of view? From everyone's? Is there an absolute point of view from which something is evil? So to ask these questions from a place of not knowing, of uncertainty, it's really vital to the practice of these precepts and of our whole life. There's a phrase, Zen sickness, that refers to when someone has had a taste, a glimpse of the emptiness of all things, of the non-abiding nature of everything that arises and passes away, one can get kind of stuck in this viewpoint and believe that really it doesn't matter then what I do, because there's no me to be doing it and no one to be doing it to, nothing that's really being done. And in one sense, that is true. But then again, that's only part of the truth. And indeed, what we do really does matter. And so these precepts brought forth again and again to point to the importance of what we do in this world, even though it be a world where there's nothing with an abiding essence. I also really appreciate how these are not inflexible rules that say, this is what you should do, don't ask any questions, just go do it. This is black and this is white, we've got a clear line, done. Because in that inflexibility, there's no place for compassion to come forth. Right, there's a sense of justice that we will now divide up what is right and what is wrong, but there's nowhere for the heart to enter into that place. Justice without compassion is a cold, cold thing. It doesn't take into account our humanness. Important for three qualities to come forth when we look at these precepts. One is wisdom. This is what we cultivate as we sit on the cushion. And as we inquire about our lives, as we go about our lives, this wisdom that arises out of our own innate Buddha nature that is there, if we will just turn inward and look. And there is compassion, also part of our, another way that Buddha nature presents itself, our naturally compassionate self, if only we step out of the way. But these two things are not enough. There must also be activity. So the precepts addresses this, that we must cease to do evil and cultivate every good. We have to actually act on the wisdom and compassion that is our birthright. So these three things always acting in concert, moving back and forth between them as we look at the precepts. So ceasing from evil, cultivating every good, and saving all beings. Sometimes this seems to be the most problematic one. You know, like maybe I can somehow muddle my way through to not cause too much harm, maybe even do a few good things, but saving all beings? What the heck? You know, like they got to take care of themselves. But this is not how it works, because we aren't really separate. We aren't somehow distinct from one another. And so caring for another person is like caring the right hand caring for the left. They're two different things, but they're attached to one body. One helping the other is really helping itself. So this saving all beings. And we have to ask, who are these beings? And who is the one who is saving? You know, these questions come up again and again, this matter of identity, of self and other. It's really central to the way that we can act through these precepts. And each precept will ask us to look at this in a slightly different way. So as I was reading over the three pure precepts this morning, having my morning cup of tea before going off to work, and I put them down for a moment and my eyes fell onto a book that I had picked up yesterday at the MIT Coop. I work just like a block away from there. It's terribly tempting. And I was in there and they have a cookbook section. I probably haven't bought a cookbook in decades, but this one caught my eye as I was walking through. And so I paged through it and decided that I would buy it. I brought it home and my husband was like, "You're going to start cooking?" Yeah. Yes, yes I am. It was a baking book. So I was reading this, so I picked it up this morning and sort of paged through it and came to the part where it describes yeast breads and the ingredients that go into them. So it told about the yeast, of course, and how, you know, important that is for creating the leavening, right, as it ferments. About the sugar that the yeast feeds on, and about the wheat and the gluten and how that creates the structure for the bread. And then it got to the part about the water. And it said, "The water brings nothing to the loaf other than itself." Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah.
And yet how vital that is. You know, this stuff that's going to be baked away in the oven. It won't even last in the bread, but you cannot make the bread without it. Mm. It doesn't have its own shape, but it creates the possibility of shape for the bread and makes it all hold together long enough that something can happen. Some transformation can take place. It brings nothing but itself. And this is what I hear in these precepts, this matter of saving all beings, that what we must bring to it is nothing other than ourselves. But we absolutely must bring it, or the bread won't hold together. There won't be any baking done. So how wonderful that nothing else is needed except what we already are, what we already have. And how vitally important to be that and bring it forth in this world. That is what these precepts are about.